You're with us for the morning show on a Tuesday. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The month of May is AANHPI Heritage Month. This is a chance to recognize the histories and cultural contributions of Asian Americans, Native Hawaiians, and Pacific Islanders. Here in Wisconsin, by far the largest Asian American ethnic group in our state is the Hmong community. Hmong refugees arrived in Wisconsin in waves, starting in the late 70s, following the Vietnam War, and ending in the mid-2000s, and that is from the We Are Hmong Minnesota timeline. Join in on the Hmong experience in Wisconsin and the Midwest, 800-642-1234. Long Vu is executive director of New Hmong Professionals. It's a culturally based organization serving Northeast Wisconsin. Long, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me this morning.
Good morning. Tell us more about New Hmong Professionals and what you're doing with it.
Well, New Hmong Professionals, Northeast Wisconsin. So just make it easy now. People get used to now is New Hmong Professionals. Original, when we started, it was just a group of individuals, professionals getting together. That's right before the pandemic, where in the valley here, we had a double murder suicide that happened. It just shook the whole community, and professional like me and other individuals say, what can we do as a group of individuals like us, professional? Well, how can we help them? Because we have to do something because there is an emergent needs that is happening in our community. So our group of individuals just gather together with no intention of being a nonprofit organization, because we want to get almost like a safe space, event based, get together, know each other, elevate each other, you know, really work together, because through this process, hopefully we can make something great because we have to be for each other. So that's right before the pandemic happened. And then during the pandemic, we went on all virtual, as you know, through this pandemic. And we realized that the needs of the Hmong community are much greater. We have to step up as leaders now, okay, and really meet the emerging needs of the Hmong community. And that's how we get this organization started.
What have been those needs in the pandemic? What have you seen?
During that pandemic, we are seeing that this the COVID-19 hit us hard. And you can imagine at that time, the Hmong or the Asians being blamed for this COVID-19, this hatred toward the Hmong. It reminds me back in the early 80s when I first came to this country, when, you know, Wisconsinite does not know who the Hmong are. So they are being targeted because of the Vietnam War. Okay. So, I mean, that hatred, harassment, you know, you walk around, people yell and scream at you. It's not safe for you to go to the store or go shopping. You know, this pandemic bring us back to that trauma time again. It's just, wow. I remember our little kids that happening, but now, and as an adult, you know, almost 40 years later, it just reemerged again, the same issue of being, you know, Hmong being targeted, hatred for the not who they are, but because the color of their skin, you know, being Asian and being blamed for it.
How do you respond? How do you tell people in your organization to respond to that hatred, to those aggressions?
Well, in this kind of aggression, what we did is that we want to work closely with the police, okay? So we ask community leaders, organization to really work on what they police, the, you know, for safety. So talk about safety, be extra patrol, look out, you know, if they need any help, there's the phone number, call us, okay? So we really work closely with the police to make sure everybody's safe. That's number one, okay? So we are on the same page and be the lookout. Another issue that we are working very closely is the Hmong community. It's okay, be on the lookout again, okay? Do not go outside after dark. If you have to go travel in pair, all right? Be careful, you know. If there's something happened to you, here's the number that you can call. take down all the information you can. I mean, if something happened, don't worry about it. You can call 911, ask for help. If you're reluctant to call, here's the number that you can call for, you know, reach us to help you. So those are basic steps that we try to prevent anything from happening.
We're talking with Long Vu, who is executive director of New Hmong Professionals. That's Northeast Wisconsin, a nonprofit organization formed at the end of 2019, beginning of 2020, and has been really working together to fight these aggressions during the pandemic and to lift up young Hmong professionals. You can join in with your experiences, your questions, 800-642-1234. Long Vu, I know it's in the name of your organization, but I want to focus a moment here on Hmong professionals. It could mean from many professions, many different areas of our society. Do you think Hmong professionals get the same level of respect and treatment as their non-Hmong counterparts among their class of professionals, regardless of where they go and do their work?
I think New Hmong Professional, as a new organization, we really strive to include everybody. Okay, it does not mean just new professional, like you mentioned. It could be anybody. Okay, and I think we, as a society, as we progress, there will be new organization step up to meet the needs of different organizations. And New Hmong Professional happen to be, you know, stepping up to meet the emerging needs of the Hmong in our community, okay? Because if we are a new organization, there's different way of solving issue, different way of meeting needs. So I hope that, you know, whether New Hmong Professional or other new organization that help in the Hmong community, we should allow them the space to help. Because the end goal is to help the Hmong community and other community at large to, you know, to create a society that is well-respect, welcoming to everybody, okay? So whether it's an older organization or newer, I hope that people realize that the goal is to meet the needs of the emerging or needs of the community or the Hmong needs, basically.
I'm wondering how the grant awards have impacted your organization. Earlier this year, Governor Evers awarded a $1 million grant to the Wisconsin United Coalition of Mutual Assistance Association, and it's meant supporting the economic development of Hmong and other Southeast Asian populations in Wisconsin. Have you felt an impact?
We do. As a new organization, I'm very, it's unfortunate that, you know, we are not recognized by the states or from different agencies, from the federal government or from the governor himself, because a lot of time there's restriction on who can apply for, and those grants, unfortunately, you know, grassroots organizations like us being new, it's very hard for us to receive funding from, you know, this type of funding, basically. Okay. A good example is like they put some restriction on you have to be a nonprofit before X amount of date. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you cannot qualify. And we have seen that happen before. You know, it's right there. You know, you have to be a nonprofit before X amount of date. And new Hmong professional like us, you know, we are not even qualified for it. So, but it's unfortunate that happened. But I hope that the whole community, other agency, whether it's federal or state, realize there's always new organization or grassroots organization really work on the ground to meeting the needs of the communities, especially the new Hmong professionals. So we really strive on meeting those needs, whether it's, you know, emerging needs, basically, all the way from your social issue, mental health, suicide prevention, economic development, elderly, you know, all those issues. And I hope that, you know, there's some recognition of grassroots organization like us to really step up and receive those funding. Otherwise, it's a challenge.
We're talking with Long Vu, who leads a nonprofit empowering Hmong professionals in Wisconsin. He was a teenager in 1980 when he arrived in Kaukauna with his parents and siblings. We're going to talk more about that. Join in to discuss Hmong business development community partnerships that have taken hold over the decades to support among refugees and future generations that try to eradicate stereotypes. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Long Vu here on the Ideas Network. We're hearing from Hmong American Voices in Wisconsin on the morning show. I'm Kedar Chirkant. The group New Hmong Professionals, formed as a nonprofit at the beginning of 2020, working through the pandemic era here, upholding a mission to help Hmong professionals in networking and mentoring and leadership, whatever else comes up in the community. Join in on your experience in the Hmong community, on partnerships. 800-642-1234. Long Vu leads New Hmong Professionals based in Northeast Wisconsin with us for about 9 more minutes. Long, I was hoping you could take us back to when you arrived as a Hmong refugee, when you came as a 14-year-old. What was that like for you in 1980?
It's really a culture shock. Growing up in a refugee camp, from 75 to 80, as a young adult, or we don't go to school basically when you're in a camp, refugee camp. You imagine a refugee camp, crowded, no place to go, you know, food scarce. So you grow up in that society for 5 years, and that's all you know. And going to school is not something that is required for you to go to school. So imagine growing up, you not knowing speaking, not knowing how to write your language, and you don't have a formal education. So when we came here, it's just a shock. Wow. You know, because honestly, when I grew up in camp, I saw one of the first time I saw Caucasian boys. I did not realize there's a lot of non-Hmong. Growing up, I thought it was Hmong, right? Now, I'm dropped into Kokona here. I'm the opposite now. I'm one of the Asian, and everybody's Caucasian. It's kind of, But the feeling is not that welcoming. I can see it happening to our elders, older adults. As the kids for me growing up, I still see those hatreds and harassment to being a refugee in this country or in Kokona. I can see sense that. So it's always a challenge growing up, trying to fit into society.
When you were bullied as a teenager, did you have some person, some place to go to talk, to get support?
Not really. Growing up, first, you're not among your friends, basically, okay? Because you are in Wisconsin here, it's kind of unique in a way because you have a lot of larger Hmong population, but again, it's not that large. So imagine going to a foreign country, your friend's not there with you anymore, right? Your cousin, aunt, they're all supposed across the country. So growing up, you know, you really need to develop that friendship again with other Hmong that's in Kokona or in Appleton. So growing up, you really need to step up. And I'm sad, but at that time, growing up, the one transportation I have is walking. Well, when I'm a little older, I get a bike. Okay. And I remember growing up in Kokona, we are isolated from Appleton. So anything that I want to go, we took the bus to Appleton, go shopping, do all that stuff, but being isolated from the rest, you know, growing up in Kokona is it's a challenge.
What do you think it's like for second generation Hmong teenagers today? What are they encountering?
Unfortunately, I think a lot of the kids right now, growing up right now, are facing tremendous hardship in a way of struggles, trauma. Okay. I think those kids are reliving what I'm going through now. It's so scary. When I work here, I realize that when we first came here in the 80s, the suicide rate among the Hmong were the elderly, okay? And now it's weird because it's the young teenagers has committed suicide or died by suicide. And when I look back at this data, now I realize they are going through a very hard time, challenging, trying to find who they are, trying to fit into society, just not American society too, but with the monk as well too. Let me give you a good example. Let's say this is a student, monk student, okay? When he or she go to school, the public or the school see him as a monk boy or monk girl, but he or she think he's American, okay? So they say, no, you're a monk, okay, right? So, and then when he go back home, mom and dad say, you are American boy. You don't speak, you cannot speak the language. You don't understand monk culture. You're American now. So you can see those push back to our children right now. They're having a hard time fitting. Yeah.
It sounds like they're trying to live in two different worlds, two separate worlds, and yet they're not fully accepted in either one.
Yes, and that is one of the challenges I'm beginning to see emerging happen to our teenagers right now. It's very hard.
We're talking with Long Vu, who is Executive Director of Hmong Professionals. This is a nonprofit working in Northeast Wisconsin on a range of issues. You can join in with your questions, what you've seen in terms of partnerships in the Hmong community where you live, 800-642-1234. Long Vu, we have talked about helping Afghan refugees at Fort McCoy and getting resettled, Ukrainians now also, who may come to Wisconsin and call home. How might Wisconsin become a more welcoming place in our communities? What would you suggest?
My suggestion is that the Hmong have been through here 40 years. Those new refugee, I'm hoping that they can reach out and let us know how we can help too. But it's unique in the valley here in the Appleton, Fox City here, new Hmong professional, we are actually working closely with other nonprofit organizations like Casa Hispanic, or People of Progression, or POP, over pointers, serving that population that you mentioned about, new refugee from Africa. Okay, so in a way, those organizations and new Hmong professionals actually forming a team of collaboration, working together. So we actually have another organization called Multicultural Initiative, or MCI. That's almost like the umbrella organization now. And our organization of like the different organizations are under there trying to meet the emerging needs of not just the Hmong population, but the whole people of color or nonprofit organization in town. So we are very work closely trying to meet all those needs. So it's not just the Hmong now, we're working as a team now, working to solve different issues, meeting different needs in the community. So I'm glad you mentioned that, asked about that question, because we are working closely with the emerging refugees, the needs in the community, and we already share resource idea how we can help them. So I'm glad you mentioned that. Ask me about that question.
I want to land here and end the conversation regarding history and remembering the history. I'm thinking of you growing up in this refugee camp that is polar opposite, totally different than what life might be like in Kakana. And in Outagamie County, the Hmong American Partnership of Fox Valley, they're creating this memorial meant to honor Hmong military veterans who served in the secret war, in the so-called secret war in Laos during Vietnam, where the CIA relied on Hmong soldiers to prevent the threat of communism from spreading. And I'm wondering what it means to you to help remember this history.
It's great that we all remember the Hmong veterans, because they play such a critical role of helping us fight the Vietnam War in that front, okay? Imagine you go into a country again, you're fighting a war, but you cannot speak the language and you cannot fit in the culture. You're as a Caucasian. You don't look Asian when you go fight that war. So you really rely on somebody, a trust friend that can really communicate with you, get the information for you, and protect you along the way. Mm. That is exactly what the Hmong have done to this country, okay? They are the inside underground group of individuals helping American fought this war secretly, okay? They are actually being paid by U.S. government to fought this war for U.S. at that time, okay? So they want their job is to rescue downed pilots. Mm. They'll be going to get intelligence. We have Hmong individuals sleep nights and day, monitor Ho Chi Minh Trail, the number of tanks coming through. They're on the ground fighting that war that we don't see or recognize them.
And Long, we are out of time. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Long Vu, Executive Director of New Hmong Professionals. News is next. Now to a check on the pandemic with a renowned epidemiologist who has followed every twist and turn. Something about Michael Osterholm that sets him apart from his peers. He's not afraid to say three words.
Probably the three most important words that I continue to say over and over again is, I don't know.
That is from his COVID podcast Thursday, his 104th episode. Join in with transmission questions, with masking, boosters, social distancing, you name it. 800-642-1234. Michael Osterholm is a professor and director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Michael Osterholm, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. Great to be with you again. Thank you.
Do you think epidemiologists, public health experts have been overly confident about COVID predictions? I mean, what do you know for certain?
Well, I think it's fair to say that this virus continues to throw 210-mile-an-hour curveballs at us, and it's really critical that we understand that so that we can anticipate the future. For example, it was a year ago right now when the country was in the sense of we're over, we're done with the pandemic. We are marching towards independence from COVID on 4th of July of last year. And, of course, then we saw what the variants did, these new variants, Delta, and then along comes Omicron. Well, prior to that time, each one of the variants that we saw that emerged, these new, basically next edition of the viruses, starting right with Alpha and Beta and Gamma, all the Greek letters that we named them, through Delta up to Omicron, we had a variant, and then we'd see a new variant. Well, now we've seen something very different. Omicron, since its arrival in November and December, has now given us a whole number of subvariants, basically children of the children. And that has now resulted in a very different epidemiologic picture. I think right now it's fair to say, Kate, we have a very different kind of pandemic going on in much of the world today compared to what we had 6 to 12 months ago.
There are some people who just don't want to hear that. They don't want to hear that the COVID is raging or circulating widely again here in our communities. They just want to go back to their lives, push this into the back of thoughts. What happens when we have this tendency?
Well, first of all, I think we all agree. We're all in that camp, okay? Mm-hmm, all of us want this to be over with. I think one of the important points to make right now is that we are actually in a better way with this virus than we were 6 months ago. And what I mean by that is that if you actually look at the number of cases, I think it's fair to say we have more transmission of this virus going on now than we have at any time since the pandemic began. The problem is that we're not counting cases like we once were because we don't have people getting tested with the PCR test, that highly effective and reliable test. Who are getting tested often are people with these home testing kits where results never get reported. I can say with absolute conviction, I know more people today and in the last 7 to 10 days who have become infected in my world than I've known at any 7 to 10 day time period since the pandemic began. Now, that's not good news. But what is good news is right now, deaths are at very low levels relative to where they've been. Instead of, talking about the thousands of deaths a day, we're now talking about 300 deaths a day, which is still a lot, when you think about 2,000 deaths a week. But it's a very different type of clinical picture. Hospitalizations have creeped up some, but they're not anywhere close to what they were during the original Delta and Omicron peak. So we're in this stage right now of where it's here, it's everywhere, but it's not nearly as bad as it was. And the question, which we all are asking, so what's next? What is next? And that's where I wish I could give you more clarity.
Where are you at with masking as you see it circulating so widely? Should people be wearing masks?
Well, first of all, let's take a step back because I've had this discussion on this program on multiple occasions in the past, and I'll just reiterate where I'm at. The fact of the matter is that this virus is highly, highly infectious. Think of yourself in a room with someone who's smoking a cigarette. If you can smell that smoke, then you are, in a sense, also experiencing what it would be like if someone were in that same room breathing air in and out but happened to be infected. Because that's what this virus is transmitted by, is aerosols, this kind of floating cloud of virus. And so you surely have to recognize that's happening right now. The challenge I think we have is that the public is over with this pandemic. They're done with it. Even though the virus isn't done with us, they're done with it. And so from the standpoint of any kind of respiratory protection, I think most people are saying, I'm not going to do it. Now, a couple caveats on that. Number one is that if you're going to use any kind of respiratory protection, make sure it's something that works. And that is, of course, this N95 respirator type mask we talk about. Not some cloth face covering, not a bandana, not a gaiter. They are not effective at all. You'll smell that smoke in that room if you were wearing one of those. So number one, it has to be a highly effective one. Number two is you have to wear it appropriately. And what I mean by that is we have continued to see month after month after month, about 25% of people, just as they were at the beginning of the pandemic, wearing it under their nose. Well, that is like shutting three of the five doors on your submarine before you take off underwater. You know, that's not going to do you any good. Mm-hmm. And so why even do it at all? And so I think those are important pieces. Now, who should wear it? Well, you know, at this point, as I just said, this is a much milder illness across the board that we're seeing. But it's not mild for everybody. We're still talking about 300 deaths a day. And in that case, if you're at increased risk for serious illness, even if you've had your four doses of vaccine, but you're older, you have diabetes, you're overweight, you have any number of these conditions that can predispose you to more serious illness, then you're the person that surely needs to be very mindful of, if I am going to be in public, I need to protect myself because the public's not going to protect me. And so I personally, because I'm an older white male, and I wear my N95 respirator when I'm in public places right now, just by the very nature of how much transmission is going on out there.
If other people aren't wearing theirs, does it make that much of a difference whether you wear yours?
It makes every bit of difference.
Okay.
Because of the fact that you are protecting yourself and you are doing everything you can. If you've been vaccinated and then you basically wear an N95 respirator. So yes, I would tell you absolutely still do it. And you can still afford yourself a lot of protection. Remember, in healthcare facilities where people wear N95 respirators, they can protect themselves dramatically from the patient population who might be infected. Well, you can do the same thing in the public.
Veteran epidemiologist Michael Osterholm, fielding your questions about masking, about boosters, about a COVID surge and circulation, questions on the summer, insights he has on what the coming seasons could entail. Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Michael Osterholm here on the Ideas Network. We are taking stock of where things are at in the pandemic with veteran epidemiologist, getting at your COVID transmission questions here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, University of Minnesota epidemiologist Michael Osterholm with us, fielding questions about new variants, about boosters for kids, masking, the grim milestone of a million deaths in our country, how that hits home. Conversation is right here, 800-642-1234 to join in. Michael Osterholm directs the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy with us for 10 more minutes. Let's look at our kids for a moment. The school year nearing an end. Masking policies have varied widely in schools across Wisconsin and I'm sure across Minnesota as well. What is your recommendation for K-12 schools as they look ahead?
Well, first of all, I'm convinced that we will be still living in a world of COVID come fall. And so we do need to anticipate this issue right now. The question is going to be, though, just what will that illness look like? And as I've just described over the course of our previous interview here, we're seeing a milder illness right now. But when we look at kids, we've had over 450 kids, younger kids, die from COVID over the course of the pandemic, many of them associated more recently with the Omicron surge. So this is not just a benign disease in kids. It more often is milder, but it's not always. And so I think that we still have to really focus on, number one, getting kids vaccinated. You're going to be hearing more and more over the course of the next several weeks about what I believe will be the imminent approval of the vaccine for those down to infants, basically under 5 years of age. But the problem is, right now, if you look at kids 5 to 11, actually, only 29% of those kids who have been eligible to get vaccines since November have been vaccinated. So one is we've got to continue to push there. The vaccine can surely reduce even more so the potential for serious risk illness in these kids. The second thing is school districts need to continue to look at their air quality in their buildings. I know this is not a short-term fix. Many of these buildings would take substantial refit and renovation to improve air, but that by itself can also be a major way to reduce the risk of transmission, not just of COVID, but of all the respiratory pathogens, including influenza. And then third, I think, what do we do about that? And it is very fair to say that masking is not ideal, particularly in younger kids. None of us want to do that. But if you're going to try to reduce the transmission, you've got to wear an adequate protection mask. And what I mean by that is something like a KN95 for kids, as opposed to just a face cloth covering. And that surely can help also reduce the risk of transmission of the virus in the school setting.
We just got word of the boosters for 5 to 11-year-old, that recommendation. There's also that second booster potential for over 50 or immunocompromised. Where are you at with boosters?
Oh, I think boosters are very important right now. You know, these vaccines have been remarkable, but they're not perfect. And what we've learned over the course of the past 18 months is that the vaccines which give you this initial big boost of protection, and in fact, during that early days of having just received the vaccine, you're really protected against even infection itself. But as time goes on, that protection wears off, and you need to basically get the booster to then boost it back up again. And while 4 to 6 weeks after you've been vaccinated, you start to see an increase again in people who are just getting infected, meaning that they have any illness. But then when you get further out than that, then you start seeing the protection slipping for serious illness, hospitalizations, and deaths. The boosters can raise that back up again. Now, the challenge we have is we can't boost our way out of this pandemic. You know, when I look at those who have received two doses of vaccine, these adults, they obviously are not vaccine hesitant or vaccine hostile. And yet, only about 35% of these individuals have gone on and gotten a third dose, when we've made it clear how important that third dose can be in protecting you against that hospitalization. So we've got some real work to do in terms of helping the public understand the importance of these vaccinations, how many doses you need, and what will we do over the future? Because as I said, I don't have any a belief that we're going to continue to boost our way out of this. People will just not continue to get vaccinated, and this is going to be a challenge.
Talking with Michael Osterholm, professor, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Michael, especially early in the pandemic, social distancing was such a buzz, making sure you kept that distance between other people. And we see now remnants as we go into different places of the signs reminding people to stay away from others. Where is the science and public health at with social distancing?
Well, you know, distance is your friend, as is time. So if you have a short amount of time in an environment and you're distant from anyone who might be infected, then, of course, that helps protect you. The problem is that we've now realized how infectious this virus really is, particularly the Omicron variants and subvariants. If you look right now at what we call BA 2.2, 1.2.1 or BA4, BA5, we've seen many super spreading events where, 38 out of 42 people in a room, or in an environment get infected just from one person. This is kind of what's happened at the White House Correspondents' Dinner and the gridirons, all these things that we've heard about. And so you can't just guarantee yourself, I'm going to be protected if I'm at least 6 feet away from somebody. That's just not in a fair way to look at this anymore. And so it is a function of time and number of people there. People, one, is just the chance of someone being infected in a room. If you have 100 people, is a lot higher than if you have only 5 people. Also, the amount of time you spend there and how much they're breathing out. Remember, keep coming back to that smoking analogy. Mm-hmm. If one person in the room is smoking, what's the chance of me inhaling that? But if 5 are smoking, what's the chance of me inhaling smoke then? And so it is going to be a situation with indoor air where you're at higher risk, but you've got to live your life. For those people who are at high risk of having serious illness, that's where, again, respiratory protection on top of vaccination plays such a key role in anything they do in that kind of public setting.
So here we are. More than 1 million people have died of COVID in our country. I know you've been recognizing this grim milestone. How well positioned are we for the next pandemic?
Well, I think for the next pandemic, which I at this point can only imagine it happening, I'm still stuck in the middle of this one mm-hmm. that we're in right now. But I worry a lot, Kate, about where we're at as a society. I think that there is less trust now for public health than any time in my 47-year career. And trust is a very important element of making recommendations to protect people's lives, to save, loved ones. If they don't believe you, they find that what you're talking about is not true, or I'm just done listening to you. And I think right now, public health is really in a bad way. There are a lot of people out there that said, I don't care what you tell me, I'm going to do X, Y, or Z because that's what I'm going to do. And so I think that element of the preparedness for the next pandemic is really a challenge. I also worry about, as a country, will we make the commitment to be prepared for future pandemics just like other countries? Here we are right now watching Congress refusing to appropriate, $20 billion after spending all the money they have as we're beginning to run short on vaccines and drugs for treating people who have COVID. That surely doesn't seem to be a sign that we're getting better prepared for the next pandemic. So I think, we can't lose the lessons that we've learned from this one, and that this is about not just making life safer and better for people, but even economically making it more stable.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your work.
Thank you. And Kate, thank you for the coverage you've given this topic. You have been a very faithful journalist to the message, to the information over the course of time. And for those of us even outside of Wisconsin, we very much appreciate what you've done in terms of getting good information out.
Appreciate those words. Michael Osterholm, professor, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Just ahead, we look at the latest approach to address the youth mental health crisis with a panel of experts. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.